the Education Subcommittee of the Joint Committee on Ways and Means for Tuesday, March 8, 2005. We will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 5527, the Oregon Student Assistance Commission. And with us this morning we have Mr. Brian Klim. And please introduce the person sitting to your left.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. This is Jesse Lorke, and he is one of our student commissioners. The commission has two spots designated for students to serve on the commission in order to ensure that students' points of views are brought to the table more directly than through just testimony and the standard ways of doing it.
And could you spell your last name, sir?
Madam Chair, it is Lorke. That's L-O-H-R-K-E.
Thank you very much. The way we're going to proceed this morning, and let me first explain that our chair, Senator Devlin, is ill today. We wish him a speedy recovery. It is our intent to finish up with the Oregon Student Assistance Commission this morning. We're planning for about 20 minutes. Does that still feel...
I think that'll be fine.
Okay. And then after we have heard from you, we will turn to our fiscal staff, Mr. Bender, and just ask him to frame what will be the next steps around the work that we will need to do, continuing work we will need to do with the Student Assistance Commission. And then after that, we will move into a public hearing on Senate Bill 5513, which is the Department of Higher Education. And so with that said, Mr. Klim, please go forward.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And it's been a good opportunity the last few days to spend with you. I sort of consider it a board meeting. I run a business, and so I consider it a meeting with my investors and to try and continue to prove to them that the company they've invested in is doing good work. What really, though, becomes more important is what our customers think in the end, because they're the ones who are going to need to use the services and have them work for them. And so on our OSAC priority list, which is page 78 in your folder and the last where we left off yesterday, the first portion talks about maintaining basic services. And I thought the best way to characterize what we do there is to show it to you from the customer's perspective. And that's why I asked our student commissioner to be here, so he could talk to you about what the agency really means to a student or for a customer in this case.
Chair Gordley, members of the commission, for the record, my name is Jesse Lorke, student commissioner on the Oregon Student Assistance Commission. I want to thank you for extending our hearing this extra time to take the time to hear the OSAC priorities from the student perspective. It's the priorities that the commission sets that really hit home. And I think that's where this commission really excels, being a citizen commission with five volunteers and two students who get out there in the community and don't just try to set the priorities from a statistician's point of view from a closed boardroom somewhere, but get out. We held hearings all across the state, heard from students and parents and financial aid administrators and college presidents and anybody who wanted to testify as to how they felt that the Oregon Opportunity Grant should be administered and the priorities of the agency should be set. The thing that we heard most of all was that the Oregon Opportunity Grant needs more funding, but not given more funding, we should keep doing what we're doing. The commission is known for doing an awful lot with the limited staff that they have. I guess I'm just trying to get across that as I started working with the commission a year and a half ago, and my appointment's up in a few months here, that I had no idea how the Oregon Opportunity Grant was administered, how OSAC took care of the different functions of the agency. I've been a part of it for some time now and have all kinds of confidence in what they're in the process that I guess that this body goes through to distribute the funds to the students in the most efficient way. They are a bunch of commissioners and staff who really care about what they're doing and making sure that the opportunity grant is kept at a meaningful level that covers the most students that it can. I think that this priority of maintaining basic services is really important. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to Claire Chem. Chair Clem.
Well, let me thank you very much for being present and for offering your testimony, which is clearly very thoughtful. Thank you very much. Mr. Clem.
Thank you. And I think I see Jesse's notes, and we both came to the same conclusion that basic services is not the right word, really, for what we do there. It's not enough to maintain basic services. We need to be excellent because people, and myself, I received that grant 15 years ago, and it led me to where my life is today. And the future of our state is obviously based in not leaving people behind who otherwise would do well for us. And there were folks who can pay, and they do pay on their own. And then there are folks who aren't going to make it without the assistance. And so for us, it means if you have a budget problem and you can only do so much through the grant, we need to go out and raise those private scholarships. We need to do the Aspire program to make sure that even if you allocate money, that those families who are first-generation college attending looking, they're not even there yet, that they know how to access the services. And so I guess our organization is really tasked with finding obstacles to access and eliminating them. And that's where I think that the right word is to maintain excellent services and to be accountable and to be flexible, because we know that the amount of assistance you're able to give us may vary from time to time. And that's where we use those private partnerships to do so well. The second piece, and this is a long-time stated goal of various experts out there, the Financial Aid Commission in the 90s, the Work Group Commission that we had this summer, the Access and Affordability Work Group, and that's expand the opportunity grants to all eligibles. But again, there's really a personal face. What that means is that right now we have cutoff dates, and somewhere in March, in most sectors, or somewhere in August in the community colleges, people get told, no, we can't afford $1,200 to give you a shot at a better life. And the budget that the governor's proposed would end that. And it wouldn't end it for everybody. It wouldn't end it for the people that are on the other side of the income cutoff. But it would end it for the historical population that we've been trying to serve. And so for the last 15 years that I've been working on this issue, from the time I was a student at OSU to now, I've never seen a governor put in their budget to make it this far. And it's a rare opportunity. It's one that I want to ask you to take because it's not going to come again. And it's, if it does, it's going to be decades. This is Terry Edelson. He
Can
is,
I ask you a
you
question, given what you just said? Faced with a policy choice, a tuition freeze or expanding opportunity grants, what then would be your advice?
You know, the rule of thumb, Madam Chair, is that when you get asked a question like that, you try and dodge it, but I'll give you a straight answer. I served as student body president of Oregon State. I served on the Oregon Student Association Board, and it was always our policy that low tuition, low or high aid would be the best world. But the bottom line is tuition has increased radically. And what I would say is that this grant targets the neediest of the needy. And tuition, because of sticker shock factors, still is a very important piece of financial aid, but this is a much more efficient way to deliver aid to those who need it rather than to a untested population. And that's not a popular statement to say, because it takes friends of ours who are about to testify next and say that their tuition policy is secondary. But I do believe that this targets it at the neediest of the needy, that it is the most efficient way to allocate money. And you know, I do believe that you can have a tuition rate that will scare people off from even trying. Even if the grant were $5,000, they would say, I'm not going to attempt that, because the sticker shock factor of a $15,000 or $20,000 or $30,000 education, even if you promise me some financial aid, most students know that that could go away the next year and then they're in trouble. But you really have to think about it from, how do we set up this grant? It's to test people who are at a family of three can only make $27,000, and to extend them a $1,200 or $1,500 grant is really making sure that the people who need it get it.
I appreciate your response.
This is Terry Edvelson from LeGrand, and he's going to talk about the last point. As Jesse mentioned, we had 8 public hearings, and especially at Eastern, where Terry's from, we heard about part-time students.
And Mr. Edvelson,
yes.
Could you spell your last name, please?
E-D-V as in Victor, A-L-S-O-N.
Thank you so much.
I've been a commissioner for about a year and a half now. Before that, I was a faculty member at Eastern Oregon University, and before that, I worked overseas in Micronesia and administered financial aid and student assistance programs for the Trust Territory of the Pacific Islands government. In the context of what I do now as a retired but active consultant in minority communities, I deal with the poorest of the poor, and that's who this grant serves by any means of testing. It is the poorest of the poor in Oregon that gets served. And I won't dwell on that, but the majority of the students, as Brian just suggested, are first-time students, first-generation students. Their families really don't understand the mating dances of higher ed that it takes to get in and stay in. So they have a whole list of really compelling challenges. Many of them derive from poverty. We heard from these students during our hearings about the challenges that caused them to move from full-time students to part-time students. And we heard, for example, at OSU Cascade Campus in Bend that half the students are part-time there. At Blue Mountain Community College, about a third of the students are part-time. And more are becoming part-time. On average, 30 to 40 students at Blue Mountain move from full-time to part-time because of the challenges they face. Challenges we heard were curriculum requirements. The nursing program won't allow a student to enroll in more than 11 credit hours at Treasure Valley, which automatically pushes them into a part-time status, when in fact they're not. The child care costs are significant factors that push people, especially single parents, as you're interested in, to part-time status. Rent and utility challenges. We heard from a single mother at Lane Community College who had just moved from an apartment into a tent trailer in a campground so she could stay in school with the limited resources she had available to her. Medical costs, family emergencies, work demands, all of these things that people like Brian and myself can adjust to and compensate for. But these students that are marginal, that move, most of them without family support, just have no resources to cope with. They struggle to stay in school. They struggle to finish. We've always had the statutory authority to fund part-time students. We've just not had the resources. I guess the funding decision of whether we are able to include part-time students, which is becoming a greater and more significant share of the student population in the state, is in your hands. I would also like to end with the fact that while this is a move in the right direction, we're still, to increase access, have to move our limit from 55% of median family income upward to 75%. That should be a long-term goal. And we need to provide a significant grant again. We're now at 11% of the cost of attendance. It would be our goal to move it back to at least 15% of the cost of attendance, raise possibilities. We also heard, and I would end on this, that it was unanimous in the post-secondary ed, higher ed, OSU, or OUS, excuse me, testimony that we fund all full-time students first and then move to part-time students. At the community college level, it was mixed. There was some request that consideration be given to funding part-time students, even though we couldn't fund all full-time students. So the governor's budget would allow us to do both, and we encourage you, I encourage you as a volunteer commissioner to do that. I do have some passion for it. Thank you.
Questions or comments? Senator Whitson.
Chair Cordley, commissioners, I wanted to go back to yesterday and the Job Plus questions that you had.
Yes.
I did some research last night, and there's about $1.8 million in available funds that are not being distributed by the Employment Division for these Job Plus positions. And then, as you noted yesterday, is $600,000 of scholarship that is not being used. The funds are generated by a $1 per hour payment to the scholarship fund for each hour that employees work under the Job Plus program. It really does give a leg up to the poorest of the poor. OSAC appears to be charged with distributing these funds to eligible students, and I would wonder if you could bring to this committee on your next visit a plan for how you are planning to address that distribution of those funds. It's a good program, and it's not being utilized.
Madam Chair, Senator Whitson, we would be happy to. And I remember a couple of years ago voting to expand the definition of who was eligible to try and get more people to use it, and obviously that didn't do it all the way. So we will go back to work and try and figure out how to get them all used.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Senator, for doing that background piece for us, and we'll look forward to receiving that information. Mr. McGee, did you have comments this morning?
This, again, is Margie Lau, and there's a spreadsheet attached that she can take you through in the last couple minutes. And page 79 has our 10% reductions, which obviously we all hope will not be necessary, but we're not in your chair, and so we have the bullets attached.
Good morning, Madam Chair. Actually, I would like to ask the committee to go to the loose documents, not the ones in your binders. They're revised to reflect some more accurate distribution of the numbers. And I'll speak first to the spreadsheet that has at the top of it on the third line the label grants/scholarships. In order to do this exercise, we were asked to, by each of the different segments within the agency's budget, to prioritize all of its programs and then to do a priority across the entire agency. The bulk, as you have heard in the last few days, of our programs are in the grants and scholarships area. So this is the one that has really the meat of the agency and its programs encompassed in it. For priority number one, this is the Opportunity Grant current program. The funding presently is about $42 million for the grants themselves, but as you can see, that figure would be closer to $55.5 million in the new biennium. That maintains the program and the grants at the present 72% of the eligible students, so it would retain the cutoff dates, unfortunately. And it maintains us at the 11% cost of attendance. The largest reason why the cost has gone up is because of what tuition and the cost of going to school has done in the current biennium. So it brings us up from the $40 million range to the $50 million range in order to compensate for that. The second priority is our private award programs. Hopefully we have helped you understand how this really helps to mitigate for many of the other added costs that students are experiencing, and does that in a very effective way by bringing private other funds dollars into the mix. And then beyond that, we have the Aspire program, which, as the committee is aware, the program delivery itself is all financed with grant funds from foundations and some AmeriCorps resources. Then the fourth priority is the CHAFE Educational Training Voucher Program that we administer for the Department of Human Services. These dollars are other funds non-limited, which seems like the process requires us to identify how to cut even our non-limited programs, but it's an important service to the Department of Human Services. So those are all basically our existing programs that are really the core in terms of how we serve the students preparing to go to school. As we move then into the newer program areas included in the agency's budget, we have priority number 5, which expands the Oregon Opportunity Grant to serve all full-time eligible students at the new award amounts. So this would add approximately 16,000 new grant recipients, and in addition to that, it would raise their grant funds to $1,500 for community college students, $1,800 for students at Oregon's public universities, and $3,600 for students attending private independent colleges. Priority number 6 is the program that Mr. Edmondson was speaking to. This is the expansion of the opportunity grant to fund part-time students. At this point, we estimate that to be about 8,500 students would meet the current eligibility requirements. Their grants would be half of those grant amounts that I spoke of earlier, so $750 for community colleges, $900 for public universities, and I have to do some quick math here, $1,800 for a private independent college. Priority number 7 is also a new aspect of the Oregon Opportunity Grant Program. This would basically encourage students to take more challenging courses while they're in high school so that they are better prepared to start their post-secondary career and to be more successful there. This would fund $500 grants, one-time grants, to students who've completed the requirements currently for the SIM or whatever evolution the SIM program takes in later modifications from the legislature. The remaining priorities are, again, important aspects of our programs. We would certainly not want to lose any of these programs. We think they fulfill very important needs across our state. They include the Rural Health Program, the Jobs Plus Program, the Youth Conservation Corps, the Nursing Loans Programs, and the Bird Scholarships. These are all important resources that help students achieve their goals and our broader state needs. And unfortunately, we had to prioritize all of these things. These are very difficult decisions for the staff to consider, or for us to think that we would have to discontinue these important aspects of how we encourage students' academic success. If you would like to then turn to the next page, this is the Office of Degree Authorization. It has really two functions. One is the program review function that was discussed yesterday. That is its our first priority in that program. And secondly is the degree validation and diploma mill investigation activities. This program is funded in a combination of general fund and other funds. We think that they're all very important functions, but again, in order to meet the requirements of the assignment, that was how we discerned them. To move on then to the administration program area, the next page. This is for staff. This staff makes sure that the checks go out the door to the students at the point in which they need them. that we're here and prepared to answer your questions for the legislature, that we're meeting all of the various requirements that we need to for our workforce. So a variety of things, making sure that the commission functions and that its meetings are well supported, a variety of duties there. So to then move on, we also have then the Information Services Division. Again, we did not reduce this any further in terms of mixing its priorities. We're really at a very close break even on this in terms of making sure I always have adequate coverage, that our systems are not down when staff are trying to function. Without those systems, much of the rest of the work of the agency stops because these processes cannot be just paper any longer and still get them done with the amount of manpower that we have available. So to move on to then the broader assignment, which is to prioritize these programs across the entire agency, you will see that the existing functions of the agency in the opportunity grant, the program review, degree validation, and the important functions that support those in terms of administration and information technology all carry a priority of one. And then beyond that, the rest of the priorities mirror those that I already discussed back under the grants and scholarships section. To then move on to the 10% reduction exercise, keeping an eye on the clock. In this area, we were asked to identify how we would reduce all of our expenditures by 10% in every fund source. I think the ones that are most keenly of interest to the committee are those that are general fund and lottery funds. This is the area that the vast majority of the agency's resources, unfortunately, are in the opportunity grant. So we had to make some reductions in the opportunity grant in the lottery funds category. That is only in the base program, although some of these resources can be moved around. So in total, in terms of making the 10% reduction, there's a little bit less than $9 million, or a little bit more than $9 million that would have to be cut out of the opportunity grant. We felt that the way in which would create the least harm, we would hope, but we would try to avoid this, would be to delay the implementation of the serving all eligibles in the first year of the biennium. Presently, schools are about to send out award notices to students that will be telling them the preliminary estimates about what their resources are going to be from the school, the federal government, and the state. And those notices at this time are going out with the least amount that a student might be awarded. If the legislature has the resources and we can expand this so we can serve all eligibles, those notices will go out amended in the future as soon as those decisions are available. We hope to be able to send those notices out, but at this point, it's not resources that students understand that they would have in hand. So it's a way in which we can reduce the amount of possible impact on students. Beyond that, the reductions that are proposed are minimal in terms of the general fund and really have to do with modifications that we're working on in order to bring our budget more closely in line with the resources that we think we'll actually take to run the agency, so we better understand all of the changes going on. I'd be glad to respond to any questions that the committee might have.
Comments or questions, members? Senator Whitsitt.
Just one, Senator Gordley, Chair Gordley. Ms. Lowell, on line 9, again, on Jobs Plus, it shows your 10% reduction shows a $74,000 loss for you folks. The $740,000, unless I'm confused, isn't really in the governor's budget. That comes from a different program altogether. So why would you reduce that $74,000?
Madam Chair, Senator Whitsitt, the assignment was that we had to we had to prioritize all of our programs. And so we're not proposing a reduction except where we had to identify 10%. And we are not speaking in support of that change, but we're simply saying that if we had to do the reduction, that we would want to do it in a way that creates the least damage possible. Given that we've had difficulty with students accessing those resources, and that there are many other resources that the agency has to also administer, we wouldn't eliminate all of anything. We would simply try to find the least damaging way in which to modify it. So we're trying to protect all of our programs, as I'm sure every agency that you hear from is doing. It's not our desire to cut any of these services.
Thank you very much. And I'm going to ask Mr. Bender for any closing comments that you wish to share, helping us frame the next steps for this agency.
Madam Chair, the next steps for this agency and for all the agencies that you're hearing before the subcommittee will be that not the following week, but the week after that, starting the week of March 21st through the 24th, you will be holding a set of meetings, that's 1 week of meetings, in which you will be looking at the performance measures and priority and program priority lists that the agencies have presented exclusively, and we'll be working to express your concerns or requests for additional information regarding these performance measures or regarding these program areas. The hope is that during this week you will be able to get more information that you'll need in order to make the decisions that are ultimately before you as to which particular programs can be funded within the funds that are available under the co-chair's budget. So LFO will be working to provide some informational materials that will assist you and bring some of this information together that you've been hearing over these several weeks, and then work with you during that time to assist in your process of figuring out exactly what additional information you need about any particular programs or about performance measures. And we will go then in depth to resolve those questions during phase two, as well as looking at the particular fiscal issues facing the agency's budgets and the fiscal proposals that the governor is proposing for them.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Mark.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Bender, could we, I don't see a date on this particular form anywhere.
Okay.
Could we maybe get LFO to insert a location for dates so we don't confuse old and new?
Very good point.
Okay, we can work on that. And we will be we'll be providing you one of the things that I would like to provide the subcommittee for you prior to this work on the week of the 21st that I mentioned is a single document that has all of the programs and the priorities that the agencies have put them in for all the agencies that you've had. So instead of having to search around to get different documents, everything should be there and everything should be up to date.
Thank you.
Final version.
Very good. Thank you very much, Mr. Bender. Well, we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 5527, the Oregon Student Assistance Commission, and thank you all again very much for your hard work and dedication. Thank you so much.
Thank you very
much.
Thank
you.
I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 5513, which is the Department of Higher Education. And we have a panel of four, starting with the Chancellor of our Oregon University System, George Pernsteiner.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is George Pernsteiner. I'm the Acting Chancellor of the Oregon University System, and I want to thank you for the opportunity to be here today and to kick off what we hope is 6 days of informative discussion with you about the Oregon University System and the Governor's recommended budget for that system. Today I'm joined on my left by Kirby Dias, who is the Vice President of the State Board of Higher Education, and she will be speaking in a little while about the Board's efforts efforts in this last year and its hopes for the future. And we'll be joined later by Dan Bernstein, the president of Portland State University, to speak about faculty salaries and important investment which we are proposing in this budget, and by Dave Fronmeyer, the president of the University of Oregon, who will talk about the innovation economy and what the Oregon University system is doing through its campuses and through various other programs to help spur that economy. My job is to give a little bit of an overview, to give you a flavor for what you may be hearing and seeing over the next six sessions, and to do it as briefly as I can. And I'm not here to talk about the budget we used to have in the good old days. You and I both know that both the economy and the change in the way that public schools have been funded in this state has required the state to reduce its appropriations for higher education over a long period of time. We know that. So we have less money today in real terms and more students than we did in the 1990s. So we're not going to talk about that. Instead, what you'll see over the next six meetings is the story of a university system that is larger, more complex, and I believe more successful than it has been at many times in its past, but one that is starting to fray and so show some serious warning signs. We all live in an era that is different from the one in which we grew up. Today, all over the world, people are using education and technology to transform what they do, how they do it, how they live, and how they think. A century ago, Americans were told that the frontier was closed. Today, a lot of people are being told that there are no more economic borders. It wasn't entirely true a century ago that the frontier was closed, and it won't be entirely true now that there are no economic borders. But it is pretty clear to me, and I think to many people, that 20th century America was animated by a much different spirit, a much different economy, and a much different technology than was its 19th century counterpart. And I think the 21st century could be just as markedly different from the 20th as the 20th was from the 19th. We're now in a global, information-based economy, an economy in which truly successful participation will demand a level of education and a flexible frame of mind beyond any that we have yet seen. Other countries and other states have recognized this shift and have begun to make investments, sometimes substantial investments, in education, particularly higher education, investments that we in Oregon have not yet been able to make. The next 6 days should demonstrate to you some of the value of making such investments and some of the problems of not doing so. We in this case means not just me and my staff, but the students, the faculty, the presidents, the board members, and the donors of the Oregon University system who will be making presentations to you. We will all try to show you who we are, what we do, how well we do it, what problems we have, how, with your help, we hope to address those problems, and the outcomes and performance that you might expect at different levels of state investment. I'm not going to say that the sky is falling. It's not. And I'm also not going to say that we can transform Oregon's economy without increasing investment and cooperation. We can't. Instead, we want to begin what I expect to be a multi-year dialogue with you about our state's future and the role of the Oregon University system, its campuses, and its stations, and that the role that we can play in helping to improve the future of the state. We want and need a partnership with the legislature, linking our performance with the funding that will help us achieve a mutual dream for a better Oregon. But having said that we want to do all those things for the future, I want to emphasize that we're pretty successful right now. And let me go through a little bit of that. We're educating more than 80,000 students this year, which is the highest number in our history. Our graduation rates have been improving from where they stood 10 years ago, and so has the rate at which freshmen come back in their sophomore year. We have 7 campuses, plus a branch in Bend, and we have stations in every corner and county of Oregon. We will confer more than 18,000 degrees and certificates this year. And that's up by 5,000 from the level seen prior to the legislature's 1999 investment in OUS that essentially helped us bring greater enrollment throughout the state. And now that enrollment is being translated into greater graduation and more degrees. and we think more economic development for our future. Our faculty will bring in almost $300 million in funded research, externally refunded research this year, an amount that is approaching the state's appropriation. That's a tribute to faculty quality, and it's a tribute because these grants don't have to come to Oregon. They could go to anywhere in the country, and in many cases these days, anywhere in the world, but they are coming here. We are helping to transform Oregon industries from high technology to nanoscience to nurseries, from food processing and packaging to timber to livestock, by educating the workforce and focusing our world-class research to help businesses in our state. That's impressive. And we've done that, I think, with a commitment to this state that shows great confidence in the future of the state on the part of our institutions, our faculty, our staffs, and you all. But there are some warning signs. Enrollment of new freshmen is not keeping pace with the growth of high school graduates. In other words, the percentage of high school graduates going on to our universities is now in decline in the last couple of years, for the first time in some time. Faculty salaries at our universities are among the lowest 30% in the country, making it difficult to retain and attract the kind of faculty we need to keep world-class universities. We have 20,000 more students than we did 10 years ago, but we have 200 fewer regular instructional faculty than we did at that time. The numbers of our extension, forest research, and experiment station faculty also have declined by about one-fourth at a time when they are sorely needed to help keep the principal industries of rural Oregon competitive in the global marketplace. There is a great disparity in the educational attainment of the Willamette Valley and that of rural and inner city Oregon, a disparity that will make success in the 21st century even more difficult for rural and inner city residents. And finally, Oregon continues to receive an F in affordability in a national report card, due largely to a lack of state investment in grant-based financial aid. So there are some warning signs, despite our success. Some questions as to whether or not we can sustain that level of success as we move to the future, at a time when, in fact, we have to increase that level of success for Oregon and its citizens to be fully participants in that global economy. The governor's recommended budget begins to address some, although not all, of these warning signs. The governor's recommended budget, I admit, does not fully fund the essential budget level, falling short by somewhere around 5 to 7.5%. depending on the area. But it does many things that focus on those warning signs. The first is, and you just heard from the Oregon Student Assistance Commission, the Oregon Opportunity Grant, which is in its budget, is proposed by the governor to double, which will help to address quite directly that F in affordability. The double-digit tuition increases that characterize the current biennium would moderate significantly in 2005-2007. Fee remissions, which are so important for universities to help assist needy students to enter college and to stay in school, would increase from their cap level of 8% to 10%. The Oregon Transfer Module, the Degree Audit System, and the Integrated Data System all are part of the proposed 2005-07 approach, making it easier for community college students and OUS students to earn degrees regardless of which of our 24 post-secondary institutions they attend, and making it possible for high school students to send their transcript data easily to our colleges and universities, facilitating their progress through the K-20 system. The freeze on faculty salaries is proposed to be lifted, and $1 million is added to begin a journey to make our faculty salaries more competitive nationally. This is essential if we are to educate Oregon's students today and educate Oregon's students tomorrow, just as well as we do it now. There's $94 million of state funds and state-supported bonds in this budget that will leverage another $261 million of capital construction and deferred maintenance projects. This $355 million investment in our campus infrastructure will create about 3,200 direct high-wage construction jobs in Oregon, while making big strides toward addressing our deferred maintenance and capital repair problems. State funds or bonds also will help support two new facilities, a joint project of Rogue Community College and Southern Oregon University in Medford, and the expansion and renovation of the School of Education building at the University of Oregon. The budget of the Oregon Economic and Community Development Department includes funds to further the collaborative efforts of research of Oregon State, Portland State, and the University of Oregon through the innovative work of the Oregon Nanoscience and Microtechnologies Institute, which directly supports Oregon economic development. These investments by themselves are not enough to create the educated citizenry we will need in the 21st century, but they start us on a path to do so. A year ago, the State Board of Higher Education was reinvigorated by a number of new members, everyone a leader in this state. The leadership of this board has led to improvements such as the Oregon Transfer Module, and I believe to much of the credibility enjoyed by some of the proposals that are before you for the Opportunity Grant and other things. The board now is beginning a consultative planning effort that will help map the multi-year course Oregon must take to ensure the success of this state and all of its citizens in the global information-based society into which we are emerging. It's my privilege now to introduce the Vice President of that board, Kirby Dias, who will speak about the responsibilities of the board and the changes the board has made during the past year. Thank you.
Thank you, Chancellor, and good morning.
Good morning. Madam Chair and representatives and senators, I want to talk to you a little bit about the higher ed board and what we're focused on. But before I do that, just for the record, my name is Kirby Dias. I'm vice president of the Board of Higher Education, and I'm most recently retired from Intel Corporation. There, my last job with Intel was as vice president and director of an organization called Intel Capital, which happens to be the largest venture capital fund in the world that is also based here in Oregon, which is kind of surprising for a lot of people, but is a very interesting fact to just kind of think about. I get an opportunity to talk about the mission, and the mission of the OUS institutions is really set in statute. And from this charge, the board has really taken a lot of initiatives around student-centered initiatives as far as speeding access and through the educational system. Also, making sure that we've got a very strong relationship between post-secondary education and the economy, which obviously they are very connected. And obviously the instructional research public service excellence that makes our institutions so viable for us in the future. You'll hear a lot of these themes over the next six days of testimony. As George mentioned, we have institutions that just span the state, and it's been my privilege over the time that I've been on the Board of Higher Education to have the opportunity to visit personally every one of these campuses for at least a day and in some cases a couple of days, and this is outside of board meeting attendance on the campuses. So I've gotten a chance to intimately get to know students, get to know faculty, and get to know some of the thought leaders in the communities in which our universities exist. And I have to say, I went in with probably some skepticism and some wonder at, you know, whether or not there could be things that were done much better, concerned that my perception was somewhat old about what happened in our universities. I was pretty impressed with both what they are doing with the limited funds that they do have in some situations, and also the excellence that I found to be just incredible. We have a lot of phenomenal assets within our state, and I'll talk about that a little bit further. In addition to that, I'm very pleased to see the kind of collaboration that is taking place across our institutions. We may compete very much on the football field, but what I'm seeing academically is a lot of cooperation across the states. And cooperation comes in the form of the Capital Center, which is cooperations between our different institutions and some of the community colleges, the University Center in Coos Bay, the Cascades campus in Bend, which is certainly part of Oregon State, but also carries courses from some of our other universities as well. And obviously, the enrollment that we enjoy at about 80,000 that you see in the chart here is indicated by each of the enrollment numbers on each, by each of the institutions, so you get a sense of kind of where the enrollment is. As George mentioned, we have not a completely new board, thank goodness, because there are some people that have been on the board before, but many of us are new. The 9 members of us are with 4-year terms. We've got a couple of students that are just phenomenal that will serve 2-year terms, and then the chancellor serves as the chief executive of that board. 9 of us were appointed early in 2004. We focus some of our initial attention on the chancellor's office refocus, and the emphasis primarily was on better accountability, better planning, better policy analysis, and hopefully some savings at the chancellor's office that could be deployed very effectively in buying down tuition and doing other things that would be very effective at the campuses. One of the things that I noticed as I traveled to the different institutions is the expertise that we actually enjoy within our different institutions and the level of accountability that we see. And this allows us to do some things that allow us to streamline very, very effectively. I'll talk a little bit more about how the board is set up and how we focus on the accountability, the management reporting, and that sort of thing to make this focus work very, very well. The board is actually made up of a number of committees that are standing committees as well as what we call working groups, and then some links to other boards and organizations. The executive committee is just that. It acts in lieu of the board between meetings. The standing committees, and the one I want to talk about the most is the finance, budget, audit, personnel, and real estate. I refer to fondly as the finance committee because that's a lot of what we spend our time on. But the Finance Committee is interesting in that their focus has really been on accountability and standardizing management reporting from all of our institutions and really paying a lot of attention to effective internal as far as and as well as external auditing of what we're doing and how we're doing it. This would be great within itself, but I think what is most striking is that the entire board almost always attends every minute of the Finance Committee. Now, I know that sounds a little unusual for those of us that are very busy and have other lives outside, but frankly, it's our fiduciary responsibility. This committee has been working very, very hard to really make everything that we do within the university system very open, very consistent, very easily understandable as we start to go forward. And so it's been really a labor, I think, that all of us wanted to make sure we had a chance to ask questions, you know, really understand what we're getting so that we can make the best decisions when we're called on to do that within the regular board meeting. We also just established, as George mentioned, a long-range planning committee that I'm pretty excited about, looking outward to, you know, 5 and then 10 years out as to where the system should be. And there's tremendous, excitement about this type of work by this board. I think many of us have been involved in strategic planning for large organizations before, and so it's very, very interesting work to do. And given the assets that we have and the partnerships that we have with the community colleges, the private colleges, as well as all of the economic development folks in the state, I think this can be done very, very efficiently and effectively. The working groups we're going to talk about in a lot more detail later, and so I'm not going to get into a lot of detail here. But some of the partnerships I think you'll find interesting. Clearly, we're part of the joint boards of education, which we've had initial meetings and initial working group meetings, and what I'm seeing is some incredible momentum and a phenomenal first meeting with coming together of where issues of mutual concern actually are and how we can really make all of our institutions more student-centered and more effective for the state. I also have the opportunity to sit on both the Oregon Health Sciences University Board as well as recently the Oregon Council for Knowledge and Economic Development. And again, as you'll see a little later, I run a working group called Academic Excellence in Economic Development, so you can probably understand that those overlaps play very heavily into my work on that in that working group.
Ms. Dias, at some point in your presentation, would you please focus on the joint boards of education and in some greater detail share with us what discussions are taking place, what are the issues, what are the priorities, what does that collaboration look like? There are at least a couple of members on this panel who've been interested in the work of the joint boards and how that work is going forward.
I'll touch on that a little bit later in some of my my materials, and if I don't completely answer your question, please feel free to ask further. Policy and budget priorities for the board and for this biennium are obviously access and access through additional scholarships in the Oregon Opportunity Grant for low-income students, making college more affordable, and I'll talk about that a little bit further, preserving the excellence, which is critical of all things that we need to make sure of, is that we don't jeopardize that, because that is the engine that provides the students who graduate as well as the research that comes out to be effective in really taking Oregon forward. And then targeting investments to spur economic development, which is a lot of the work that I've been personally involved with. We've got three working groups. You'll notice they are chaired by both a member of the Board of Higher Education as well as, in most, president of a community college, so we bring that to the party. The other comment that I would make about these working groups is they also include constituents from all different areas, faculty groups, faculty members, students, student groups. Oregon independent colleges are represented. Obviously, the Oregon University System, the community colleges, most of the economic development agencies where it applies. So there's a tremendous number of people that are engaged in these discussions as we start to move forward.
Before you go forward, I would like to go back to the policy and budget priorities slide for a moment. And the caption, target investments to spur economic development. Could you say more about what is the relationship there to work that's going forward with the Oregon Economic and Community Development Department? Is there a collaboration?
There absolutely is. In fact, you'll see anything in that particular realm coming out of their budget, not out of ours, and their focus is there. But, yes, we've been collaborating very closely. And I'll talk even specifically about which items that we'll be talking about, Madam Chair.
That would be very helpful. Thank you.
Good question, because, you know, sometimes this gets pretty confusing even for me. The first I wanted to talk about is excellence in delivery and productivity. This is really a focus on improving the transfer rate of our Oregon students, really improving graduation rates, cutting the time to graduation for those students that feel that they would like to graduate in a shorter period of time, and obviously just focusing on really streamlining things all the way, frankly, from high school through community college through a four-year institution. Because for the student, they don't really want to think about whether or not they just went past another system. They just want to know whether or not credits and what they're doing is going to move them through the system so that they can get to the degree and actually start to contribute to society in general. One of the things that has been very positive here is a working group to focus on something called the Oregon Transfer Module that allows students to easily transfer their core courses from one institution to another. Surprisingly enough, often the community college transfers were very smooth, but when you had to have universities sitting in completely different geographies in the state, often it was difficult to go from an Eastern Oregon university to, say, a Portland State University, because there just wasn't that focus. And this is just an incredible opportunity and some coming together of all of the constituents to make this happen. And what has been amazing to me, very honestly, is the fact that it is happening as we speak. I mean, they're starting through this. Students get to take advantage of this right now. And that's incredible when you think you've got to get all the faculty on the same page, all the provosts, all the presidents, to kind of come together and make this all happen. It's not a particularly simple process. So pretty impressive. The other thing that I will highlight here that's been very rewarding is the focus on allowing high school students to start to take some of their college courses early. And I don't know about your experience in high school, but frankly, my senior year in high school was not exactly the most academically focused year that I ever had. And frankly, if I had had the opportunity to take community college courses at that point, it would have probably made that year much more robust for me in general. And so this allows the students that wish to do that to actually get the opportunity to do that and move their college degree a little closer. Obviously, one of the other focuses for this particular committee is making sure that the courses that we have really meet the students' needs, so students aren't delaying graduation in order to just get into a couple of courses in order to graduate. So, again, another focus that will take them across organizations. There are two things that are very, very important. Certainly the Oregon Transfer Module I talked about a little bit earlier, but also a data system that allows you to take a look at where a student is at any point through their K through 16 period of time so that you can actually track the student can track themselves, and the student can know what they need to do to complete the next degree. And again, those are areas that were very excited about getting funded because they're relatively low dollars and pay back very substantially for the student. The other comment I would make on excellence in delivery, and an example, again, my dream would be that the disciplines also take the lead and start to move in a direction that allows students to transfer in a particular discipline from one educational institution to another. I think the Oregon Consortium of Nursing Education has done a phenomenal job through a voluntary effort. I mean, this is the community colleges, the private colleges, the universities all getting together and saying, okay, we all train nurses at different levels. How about if we provide dual enrollment and this process of being able to move from any place to any place and still get either a two-year or a four-year degree? So pretty impressive work has gone on there in a particular discipline. And again, you can visualize this in business, which has already started as well. You can visualize this in physics, my particular background. You can visualize this in a lot of other disciplines as well.
Madam Chair.
Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Madam Chair. She knows me. I spend more time with her than my wife. Like,
you do want to explain that.
I understood it perfectly.
My wife does. Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Dyes, I'm a big supporter of this modular thing, and I think we want to look for your leadership in making that happen as soon as possible and being as flexible as possible. I'm looking to help you bring down costs, and I think this is one way. I also think the high school putting the students in classes. I hear stories in my area about 12th graders having two classes or three classes and not really utilizing their time, and that's when they get in trouble.
That's right.
When my son, if he wasn't busy, that's when he got in trouble. So we need to be sure that those kids are being. We use that time to really help them make the next step. My question to you is. How about online? Is the OUS looking, in this committee, looking at more expanding online courses? I know in my experience I had to take a correspondence course back then was helped you and maybe make up some time so you could work and things like that. And I know a lot of colleges are, and it's expanding in our technology online. So I hope that we can do that to also drive down the cost of to students.
Yeah, Madam Chair and Representative Wisnett, we are clearly focused on online delivery in many cases. Obviously, not all courses work for online delivery, such as lab courses, but many of them do. And even the nurses program has embraced online delivery of courses. And I'm with you. I had a daughter and now a son-in-law going through college, and I can remember taking online courses, and they weren't nearly as effective. I think we found the key now. They're very effective, and some of the most effective courses that we deliver. So very, very important aspect as well. Access and affordability, which is really was discussed a little earlier in your day today, is pretty critical as well. And one of the things that I have to say is as I've gotten a chance to travel the state, and as I said, I met not only with the universities and sometimes the community colleges, but also what I would refer to as the thought leaders in the community that I had an opportunity to usually have lunch with or something. And one of the things that struck me is how often we have junior high school students and the families of those junior high school students that see college as just completely out of reach. And it's hard to be pretty motivated in high school when, as a junior high school student, you know that you have no chance of going on to college. Now, I was a first-generation college student, and my parents and obviously the state that I was in, which was Idaho at that point, I came from a small rural area as well, I knew I was going to have that opportunity to go to college, that the key for me was to focus on my grades and really, you know, get there. Today, the students that I got a chance to meet with and some of the parents, I hate to say they feel hopeless, but it's very, very concerning if there's not something they can grab hold of to say, yeah, there's an opportunity for my children or me if I'm a junior high school student. And again, I think this reaching out into the high school today with college students, with college courses, and then reaching out to the junior high to talk about how it's possible to go on to college with things like the Oregon Opportunity Grant are just absolutely phenomenal programs to start to think about investing in. Obviously, from a budget standpoint, the support from the governor's budget for the Oregon Opportunity Funding, which was discussed earlier, will make a tremendous difference with the $91.6 million that he recommended to improve that grant. In addition, we've committed to moderating tuition increases to about 5% to 7%. The board has been adamant that we don't want any more double-digit increases in tuition. It's just incredibly disruptive in moving us forward. Now, I say that knowing that it's an incredible challenge to stay at the excellent level and still say we're not going to continue to move forward with tuition increases that are double-digit. And obviously, you play an incredibly important part in helping us to maintain that level. Phasing out limitation on free remissions, which again permit some good assistance to low-income students for particular universities. And then obviously the more recent Voyager Finance Assistance Program for those returning National Guardsmen and women that the board just recently approved and obviously was highly recommended. The committee that I actually am chairing is called the Academic Excellence and Economic Development Committee. And again, our charge is pretty simple. It's go out and find the 2 to 5 economic development initiatives that are going to build academic excellence within the OUS institutions and will show the best return for Oregon over the next 20 years with interim periods of time of showing, you know, some progress to date. And again, the focus here is on every part of Oregon, so it's not just everything. It's focused on primarily excellence that we see in our institutions today, as opposed to we're going to invent it and try to, you know, tell someone to go do it. And then, obviously, things that are more exciting and relatively easy to explain. From a budget standpoint, the things that we're focused on at this particular point in time is faculty recruitment. George mentioned we are below where we need to be from a faculty recruitment standpoint, and the $1 million will help tremendously there, and obviously lifting the freeze. Support for the Oregon Nanotechnology and Microtechnology Institute, which again is a formation between three of our largest institutions, in addition to researchers from the dental school at OHSU, from Southern Oregon University, which is often not mentioned but clearly is an important part of this consortium, the Oregon Graduate Institute, and as you can see, as this kind of balloons, it becomes more and more of an overall university push, because we've got assets that sit in these campuses because of faculty's expertise that we can kind of bring to bear on this opportunity. The Engineering and Technology Industry Council, which again is a focused area of funding that that provides for doubling of the engineering graduates, doubling of the information technology graduates, and doubling of the research dollars that go into these institutions around this sort of thing. Now, frankly, I was involved with ETIC a bit when I was still at Intel, and I thought it was primarily focused on the technology industry. And I'm here to tell you that the surprise of my life is when you look at the graduates and you look at what the benefits have been for this program, sure, the technology industry has gained, but more of the gain has been in technology positions that are in what I would consider very non-technology types of companies. And as a result of that, ETIC and their membership has expanded to include almost every industry in Oregon. So it's really quite a dynamic organization. And obviously, with the industry supporting $2 to every $1, or sometimes $3 to every $1, it's a pretty efficient way to fund. And then, obviously, last and certainly not least, is the deferred maintenance and capital that George mentioned before. This is an immediate economic opportunity for the state in general, and also furthers excellence within our institutions, so important from that standpoint. Now, with that, I'm going to say a couple of comments on the joint boards, and then I'd like George to comment as well. I mean, the kinds of things that make the joint boards work really well together are things that allow you to do student-centered work. In other words, thinking in terms of a K through 20 system as opposed to K through 12, community college, and then your four-year institutions. So thinking in terms of how can we really efficiently use dollars and serve students by looking at it as an overall system, and where do the barriers lie, and how can we remove them as we start to move forward. So those are the things that happen there. And obviously, the two things that we talked about pretty significantly at the first joint boards is the Oregon Opportunity Grant and the additional funding there, and what a big difference that will make in, this may sound really bizarre, but actually in the quality of education in K through 12. Because again, hope means an awful lot to a student when you're in junior high school. And if you see that as something that you can attain, in some cases it changes the way you look at your high school years in school. And so there's obviously some opportunity from that standpoint. And then obviously the other area of focus has been in removing barriers and allowing high school students to start to take college credit earlier, as well as making sure that we've got very, very smooth transitions between community colleges and four-year institutions. George, comments? Other comments you want to make on the joint boards?
Yes, well, the joint boards met, I believe it was last month. I lose track of which month is which. It had not met earlier in 2004 and was supposed to have. We actually appointed the members late in the year, and I'll have to take responsibility for that. But the meetings that were held, and I think the important thing to note is the level of cooperation that occurred among the members of the Higher Education Board and the Board of Education. And it's centered around trying to figure out how, for the entire state, we're going to address some very fundamental issues. And Kirby mentioned some of those. Some of them deal with how you motivate middle schoolers to want to continue their education and to have a dream for what their futures can be. Some of them dealt with the disparity that exists in terms of educational attainment among the parts of Oregon, rural versus Willamette Valley. Some of them dealt with also something that the Joint Board's Articulation Committee is working on, which is to deal with proficiency or achievement-based admission into college so that it isn't always just a look at seat time that gets you to where you're going. Those things were laid on top of, really, the kinds of things that the Articulation Committee had worked on before, which dealt more with interlocking the curricula of the community colleges and the university system in a way that allowed for more seamless transfer. The Joint Boards also took a look at, didn't really take a look at, but heard about the dual enrollment agreements, which now exist among all of our universities and most of the community colleges, and many of which now focus on specific majors. Kirby mentioned the need to have the ability to know when you're in a community college that what you're taking will count towards the major. And dual enrollment and articulation agreements that have been set up among the universities, particularly Oregon State and Portland State have the most, and a variety of community colleges are helping that. And the Joint Boards met about all of that, but mostly they talked about what do we want to be in 20 years and agreed that they would get back together and begin the process of trying to do the planning. As you know, as I mentioned before, the State Board of Higher Education has created a long-range planning committee that will work with that group, but the Joint Boards actually become the mechanism for taking a look at K through 20, not just at OUS and at K-14 independently, so that the work of the State Board of Higher Education and the work that happens in the K-14 segments will be brought together at the Joint Boards, trying to develop then a K-20 plan that hopefully will animate the discussions we'll have in the next biennium.
Is there a reason that pre-K is not included in that look?
It actually is. I neglected to say it. I'm sorry.
Yes, it very definitely is.
I just wanted to give you an opportunity to say
good
that.
Good observation.
Thank you.
Also, is there a forum that provides an opportunity for private institutions to interact with our public institutions, looking at what might be common agendas, where there may be a need for alignment. Again, if the greater good is serving the needs of all of our students, whether they choose a public institution or a private institution, again, is there a forum? And if so, how and where is that convened?
Madam Chair, I'll give two examples of which I'm aware because I participate in them, and other than that, Kirby may have others.
I may have some others.
On our working groups, we have involved, particularly in the Access and Affordability Work Group, members from the Oregon Independent College Association as part of the effort, and in fact, the former president of one of the, or a couple of the privates, as one of the members of the committee. We also meet, and I met not very long ago, with all of the deans of education, public and private, in the state, to try to map a course for what teacher education programs can be doing, should be doing, to connect back into the school system so that we, in fact, have the kinds of education that we need in order to, as we move forward into the next decades, and we had a very good session about that. We also meet periodically, or I meet periodically, with all the presidents of the independent colleges to hear what they think their major issues are, and I try to do that as frequently as possible, and Kirby has even better examples.
Well, as the Academic Excellence and Economic Development Committee does include private institutions, and they are certainly invited. I, too, with George, have met with many of the presidents of the private colleges, primarily because economic development is on the top of all of our minds, so it becomes an important topic to see where we can work together on some of those kinds of things. In addition to that, I sit on the Board of Regents for Linfield College and have done that for a number of years before I became part of the Board of Higher Education, and I take that seriously because it allows me to kind of see the public versus private and kind of understand where some of those synergies are. So it does help.
Senator Walker.
Thank you. I had the good chancellor in front of my education policy committee, and we asked some questions to be responded to in writing, and we did get a response back on March 4th from Nancy Heiligman, who is the interim associate vice chancellor. And I would like to make that available to Mr. Bender to copy for the members of the committee, because it's very forthright and answers the questions that we had laid out. And I think the committee will want to see some of the responses, because we asked specifically about what the working groups are doing, what their short and long-term plans are, what savings were achieved in the reorg, and those kinds of things. So I'll pass that down. The dais here. And then if I could ask, Madam Chair, the Chancellor a question.
Certainly.
Chancellor Pernsteiner, you talked about the system and how the governor's budget falls short of funding the system by 5 to 7.5%. And then you went on to talk about some of the good things in the budget. You know, we always try to find some good things, and there's a lot of grim bad things, too. My question to you is, and I couldn't find it in my materials, so I must have filed it somewhere else at the moment, but I read an article recently where the governor was over in Bend and speaking to a group of business leaders, I think, and he surprised everyone there, including members of the board, the higher ed board, about how he wanted to turn the branch campus in Bend into another university, making an 8-university system. I was surprised to hear that. I think members of the board were surprised to hear that. And given that we can't fund the budget, you're 5 to 7.5% short of funding the budget now, I'm going to put you on the spot, and I'm sorry to do that. But what do you think about expanding the system to include 8 universities?
Chair Gordley, Senator Walker, when the governor spoke about the need for higher education in Bend, it caused us to want to take a look again at what we had said when we set up the branch campus in Bend. As you'll recall, as you may not recall, as we said at that time, we were going to take a look at our experience after 5 years and to see whether or not the needs of the citizens of Central Oregon were being met by the approach we were taking. Concurrently with the governor having made his comments, and he made them actually at a retreat of the Board of State Board of Higher Education, so Kirby was there as well. I'd received a letter from a former member of the CORAB board. You may recall that was the Central Oregon group that predated the establishment of the Bend campus, that sort of did some of the thinking about how to do that, raising some questions about how we thought we ought to interact with the community college in Bend and how we can make both the expansion plans and the administration of both those entities congruent with one another. another. So we are facilitating a meeting in Bend, which I think will happen in the next couple of weeks, to take a look at the current situation with the branch campus, the current situation with the community college, the plans for both to meet what are some significant higher education needs in the fastest growing area of the state. We understand that we've got to figure out how to deliver an appropriate level of quality higher education service in Bend. And we will be having those discussions over there. And what the governor said to the board and had said to the folks, I think, at the Bend Bulletin at a different time was he wanted the State Board of Higher Education to think about how best to do that and bring something forward in the next biennium. And so that's why we've started these meetings over there.
Okay, that kind of answered my question. And I understand that you're in a sensitive spot. I'm not going to press you any further. And I appreciate your answer. It's an honest answer. But I want this committee to be aware that that was what the governor said. And I think we need to be concerned about whether we want you to go in the direction of making that a full standalone university or whether we continue it as a branch campus. So that's kind of why I put that out there. And okay. You know, thank you for your answer.
Representative March and then Representative Wisnot. Anyone else who would like to get in the queue?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And I believe along that line, we need to study all the options for higher education in this state and throughout Oregon and throughout particularly rural Oregon. The education disparity does bother me. And I think it's also linked to the task force that you're on in terms of if there are not jobs available in the community that require higher education, then you're going to have a disparity in that attainment issue. There's the definite link there. So in your task force, one of the things that we need to look at are there industries that we can locate in rural Oregon that will provide both the jobs and the incentive for the educated people to stay there or return home after they've come over to the mountain? So, one thing that I'd like for you, the university, to bring back is what's the headcount at the Coos Bay University Center, and do we offer 4-year degrees in that? And is that another model, perhaps, instead of a full-blown 8th campus? The idea is to get education to the people where they need it, not necessarily to build monoliths or construct another full campus, unless that is what's really needed. Then, now this is also for future return, which of the community colleges are not really fully at the table yet for dual enrollment? We need to work with those community colleges to make sure they're working with the appropriate universities to ensure that we have a seamless system throughout. So thank you, and you can comment later.
Okay. Thanks.
Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think I wasn't going to comment on this, but since Senator Walker is focusing on my campus in Bend, I think that number is wrong. I think it's 600 instead of 438, six something for this year's enrollment. We appreciate this body, the legislature's approval to put a 4-year school in Bend, which is the fastest growing. I think it's one of those stories, need and access. We talk about access. And in that area, there's not a convenient access. I think this, you build it and they will come. I think, as the Chancellor said, I think we're looking at it. And I think that the demand will be there. I think it will satisfy or help a lot of students obtain a 4-year degree in that area that maybe couldn't if they had to travel across the mountains. So appreciate this body's, again, approving that university. And I don't think it was a 5-year and then we're going to look at what happened. I think myself and the people in Central Oregon think that was a commitment that this legislature made and the governor made, that we would slowly bring it on. We're working through the community college.
Madam Chair, if I might respond to Representative Wisnett, I don't want to leave a misapprehension. The five-year review was something we were to bring to the board to say, how well is it working? And that's what we're intending to do. But we're expanding that review to include now the community college discussion as well.
If we could get a confirmation on what is the actual student count at the Coos Bay campus, that would be helpful. We've heard two different numbers here. Senator Whitsitt, and then we need to look at making a transition to the next panel.
Chair Gordon, Chancellor Prinsteiner, in some of the maps that we've seen on demographics, it shows that the access of rural Oregonians to Eastern Oregon, rural Oregonians to the Oregon University system is restricted. And some of us think that the disproportionate reduction of funding to the extension services, ag forestry experiment stations, this type of community and industry outreach in Eastern Oregon is directly correlated with that. Could you address that, please?
Senator Gorley, Senator Whitsitt, I see them as two related but separate issues. And let me talk about first the access to post-secondary education. The educational attainment in the rural counties is, we have a map somewhere of it, but it's roughly half of the educational attainment in the Willamette Valley. And I see that as a serious problem for the economic and social future of those counties and something that we need to address. I'm mindful of the fact that Eastern Oregon University has increased its enrollment by 1,000 over the last 10 years, but that's really not enough to really get at that issue. And so we know that that's an area that our board committee on long-range planning is going to be spending a lot of time thinking about over the next year. With regard to the statewides, it's related, but I don't think it's exactly the same, because the statewides provide a service that for the most part is different than direct educational instruction. It's often times both research and the kind of hands-on consultation, if you will, with businesses and with individuals in those communities. We are very concerned about being able to maintain an adequate level of service in many of the counties. We've had a reduction, as I said earlier, of about one-fourth in the number of faculty associated with the work of the statewides. That will translate also into fewer federal dollars, and we understand that because there's a lot of formula-related stuff that deal with that. And it's something that the folks at Oregon State in particular are thinking about: how do we provide an adequate level of service in various parts of the state if indeed we're facing these kinds of reductions. I think on day three, which is this Thursday, the folks from the statewides will be making presentations, and my hope is you can see then both the kinds of impacts that they have, which I think is significant, and the kinds of ways that they and Oregon State are trying to address the budget situation in which we find ourselves.
Follow-up, please.
Certainly.
On the certainly extension and experiment stations and so forth are critical to the economic development of the rural areas. And I would respectfully beg to differ with you about the part on the education. I think that the contact with rural students by these extension people, demonstrating the possibilities and encouraging thoughtful processes on change and so forth are critical to getting those students to come to your universities.
Senator Gordon, Senator Whitsitt, I appreciate that. It makes me think that's a good idea. It makes me think that may be one of the ways we look at addressing the other problem. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chancellor, are you ready to make a transition?
Yeah, I am ready to make the transition. Thank you, Chair Gordley. President Dan Bernstein is now going to address you about faculty salaries, and President Dave Frohnmayer will discuss economic innovation. And at that, I think I will leave. Thank
Excellent.
You very much.
And thank you very much for your presentation. And I also just want to take a
point of personal privilege, and thank you, Chancellor, for your commitment to growing cultural competence in our Oregon university system. I'm sure that's a subject that we'll be hearing more about in the days ahead that we spend with the Oregon university system. But again, your commitment is very much appreciated. And thank you very much for your service on the board, Ms. Dias. Batting next, two presidents, Dan Bernstein, Dave Frohnmayer. Welcome.
Thank you. Good morning. Chair Gordley, members of the Education Subcommittee, I'm Dan Bernstein. I'm the president of Portland State University. It is often said that students are the heart and that faculty are the soul of the university. And today I want to talk about our soul, the OSU faculty who teach, do research, and are engaged in service throughout Oregon. Today I'm representing faculty members throughout Oregon who challenge and encourage students, who make contributions to communities, who are key to Oregon's economic sustainability, and who affect Oregon's national and international reputation. In my formal remarks, you will see that I have identified examples of faculty members from across the system representing nearly 3,400 faculty who teach our students, engage in cutting-edge research, and make substantial contributions to economic development and to their disciplines every day. But in the interest of time, I won't identify those individuals today. The faculty, though, are key to the OUS reputation. They are key to our ability to recruit and retain highly talented students, and they are key to new innovations, to new discoveries, to new products, and to economic development opportunities. And that's why I'm really here today, and I'm passionate about investment in faculty, and because an investment in faculty is really an investment in excellence. OUS faculty have gone without significant investments in salaries for the last 2 years. On some campuses, raises have been scarce since 2001. Now, what does that mean for our ability to attract and retain faculty? It means that compensation has not kept pace with the cost of living, nor has compensation been able to match what other institutions, both in the public and private sector, are offering. Both of these factors send a message to faculty that it will be hard to get ahead in Oregon. Consider housing in Portland alone. The average cost of a home in Portland was up 10% last year. Now, that means good things for faculty who have already purchased homes, but it also means that those who are new to the area or who are being recruited have a difficult time affording a mortgage. The result of Oregon's lack of investment in faculty has put our universities at risk. In the past, we've been able to balance health care and retirement benefits and the quality of life with salary, and thus have competed favorably against other states by selling the overall compensation package. However, we've lost ground in that area. When you consider the total compensation packages for faculty and compare them against our peer institutions, the reports are very disheartening. PSU is ninth out of our 10 designated peers. The University of Oregon is ninth out of 9. And OSU is 7th out of 8. There isn't much in the chart on the screen that would give a prospective or a current faculty member much hope. As outlined by the consequences on the screen, the result of the lack of investment in faculty salaries and hiring is clear on all of our campuses. And I want to address just one consequence that is particularly challenging on our campus. The overall lack of compensation is compounded by a severe compression problem. That means that our faculty that we are hiring now are being hired at salaries that are equal to or above faculty who have served our universities with distinction. And this problem was exacerbated last biennium when the legislature adopted a budget note mandating a faculty salary freeze. What does that mean for faculty retention and recruitment? It means that we're losing highly talented faculty. It means searches sometimes don't result in hires, and it means lost ground for our departments and for our students in achieving the levels of excellence needed to meet the workforce needs of Oregon's economy. Let's consider the facts about the real costs associated with our current salary levels. Just last week, I received an email from the University of Oregon indicating that one of its distinguished faculty is leaving to accept an endowed position at the University of Connecticut. At Oregon State University in 2003-2004, the faculty leaving that institution for better positions took over $10 million in funded research with them. At Portland State, we have had our share of faculty leaving for better paying positions as well. Just this term, I was notified that one of our assistant professors in the School of Business Administration has taken a position at another university that afforded more money. 2 years ago, we lost an English professor who left a position that paid $41,000 for a position that paid $85,000 at Cornell. That same year, we lost two faculty members in the College of Urban and Public Affairs, positions that paid substantially more. Some of our faculty who are leaving for other positions report that it isn't based just on the initial salary that they are offered, but instead it's the potential for receiving consistent raises based on their annual contributions to students and to the campus. In addition to the faculty who are tenure track, we are also losing fixed-term instructional faculty as well as research faculty for positions that pay substantially more. Another aspect of the faculty salary challenge is the inability of our institutions to recruit outstanding candidates for vacant positions. At PSU, in the last 3 years, we've had three failed searches for dean-level positions. And in two of those instances, we lost the first candidate because of our inability to compete with salary requirements. In one search, we were unable to meet the salary demands of any of the top three candidates. We have since reopened the search, and we have hopes that we will have a successful completion this year. But this problem raises questions about our ability to achieve our first choice in candidates who we are selecting through searches. And the experience is really similar at all of the OUS institutions. When the most sought-after faculty start leaving an institution, other faculty will follow. Faculty want to be associated with the best faculty groups and highly respected programs. One great faculty member lost for salary reasons may turn into a sequence of lost opportunities at our institutions. So how do we change this downward spiral? How do we refocus our efforts on excellence and opportunity? We need an investment strategy for faculty and for higher education. The first step is to adopt the governor's recommended budget that eliminates the salary freeze, includes minimal increases in compensation, and establishes a $1 million fund to assist in recruiting and retaining faculty. Although this package will not solve the problem, it makes a very strong statement that our seasons of disinvestment are over and that the state recognizes the importance of investing in faculty. If the legislature adopts this package and it joins a partnership with the institutions to address the salary package, we can begin a new day, one where we can look to the future, and you are giving my colleagues hope for the future. We know the problem won't be resolved in 1 year. We know we have to be partners with you in securing private funding to help with faculty salary packages. Your support, however, for the governor's budget means we will have a new opportunity and hope for the future in attracting the best faculty to Oregon. Thank you for this opportunity to talk about this critical issue and the success of our Oregon higher education institutions.
Thank you, Dr. Bernstein. Senator Winsett.
Chair Gordley, President Bernstein, something just jumps off the page at me on this competition in the faculty marketplace. University of Oregon and PSU are in the bottom 5 percentile of the ability to pay your faculty. OIT is in the top 40% of the percentile, and OIT arguably
prepares its students for the workforce better than any other of the Oregon University system. So could you address that disparity?
Chair Gordley, Senator Whitsitt, I think that part of that disparity is related to the peculiar nature of OIT and the concentration of the technical allied disciplines in the whole area of high technology, and therefore their salaries, when looked at as a whole, are higher. When you look at the salaries across the board at the more comprehensive universities with broader disciplines, I think the disparity gets exacerbated.
Okay. Thank you, Chair Gordy. Members of the committee, for the record, I'm Dave Frohnmayer, President of the University of Oregon. Very pleased to appear with you today and to talk about the innovation economy in the brief time that has been allotted and that remains. Let me start with a fact and an experience and go from there. The fact is that according to the President's Council of Economic Advisors, the robust growth that characterized the United States economy, which is unparalleled in the history of the world since World War II, is due 50% of it to research and development in the United States, the vast bulk of that conducted in America's research universities. The second, the experience occurred to me almost exactly a year ago when I gathered in Hong Kong at the invitation of that government with university presidents from around the world. I was only one of only two from the United States. The vast bulk were from Asia. And to hear their recounting of the amounts of enormous investment in technology and science education made me really fear for the future of the United States in a competitive global economy, because these nations are serious, they are making investments, and in a global economy they will be in a competitive position which we have never to this point imagined. So that means that the particular segment which it's my privilege to testify to you this morning about is particularly appropriate for the future of Oregon and our citizens and our students, as well as from the United States of America. We know that the winners in this world economy today are those who find a market for new products, who find new ways to add value to existing products, who are able to find niche markets for particular products, and are able to increase their productivity and their responsiveness to their consumers. All of these options require a high degree of innovation. All of them require an investment by the state. And every dollar this investment has invested has an enormous leverage, responsibility, and in fact outcome. Every state dollar invested by this legislative assembly in research and development typically leverages $20 in federal and private funding. That's a return on investment validated by Oregon's experience. And so what that tells us is that the kinds of investments that we are asking for in this particular component of our testimony has a high payoff for the future of Oregon and is also essential. The governor's budget that's before you has four initiatives that I'll summarize only briefly because they will come to you again in further testimony. The first of them is Senate Bill 175, which establishes the Oregon Innovation Council, which itself consolidates prior existing efforts in a new 15-member commission composed of legislators, business representatives, higher education representatives. The second is Senate Bill 186, which in a $2 million appropriations request establishes the Oregon Commercialized Research Fund to help entrepreneurs and small businesses translate ideas into new technologies. The third is ONAMI, a small acronym for a very big and exciting effort in which I'll speak more about in just a moment. The Oregon Nanoscience and Microtechnologies Institute is asking for a $7 million investment in the OECDD budget, which has an expected return on investment of $20 for everyone that you invest. All of these three initiatives are going to be consolidated, we believe. This is, of course, your choice as legislators in Senate Bill 838, which is currently pending before Senator Walker's Education Committee, but which has a subsequent referral to this committee. And finally, ETIC, which again I'll testify about in just a moment, asking for a $21.7 million investment in this budget, a particular entity which has been established since 1997 and has a track record that's simply astonishing in its positive impact on Oregonians. As I mentioned, the Oregon Innovation Council is the first of these. It would help to move ideas into the marketplace and help us to get through the early stages of businesses. The Commercialized Research Fund answers a separate need, which is how to avoid what's known in the trade as the Valley of Death. The Valley of Death is that huge gap that occurs between a bright idea in a research laboratory and the actual capacity to get it to market. That's where venture capital comes in. That's where seed money to continue a struggling business with a great idea comes in. All of this would be done in Oregon to help struggling small businesses reach this next stage of development that has such promise. And now, if I will, ladies and gentlemen of the committee, let me address ONAMI, the Oregon Nanoscience and Microtechnologies Institute, because this really is an unprecedented collaboration. It's collaboration in the best sense of that word between at least four entities in the Pacific Northwest with the promise of including many others. Those four public entities are the University of Oregon, Oregon State University, Portland State University, and the Pacific Northwest National Laboratories across the river in the state of Washington. In addition to that, of course, OHSU and other institutions associated with the Oregon State System of Higher Education are actively involved, as are industries including HP, Intel, FEI, ESI, Pixelworks. It was established last session with $1 million of general fund for operations and $9.5 million in capital bonds. In less than 2 years, and think of this in terms of the gap that it requires for seeking federal funding and all the grant applications and what's involved, it has generated $28 million in new federal funds alone. Today, ONAMI involves more than 50 research projects, $11 million in research expenditures in fiscal year 04. It involves 70 participating faculty and scientists throughout our institutions. Now, let me say why I think it's important as a person in higher education, but also as a person who cares fervently and deeply about Oregon's future in this area. This is a ground-up collaboration. That is to say, it originated with the scientists themselves. It was not imposed by the legislature and not imposed by the presidents of the universities, much as we wished for it. We have encouraged this collaboration in every way, but it has grown organically from the intersecting needs of a number of disciplines and schools and colleges in our system, and we should be very proud of that entrepreneurial spirit of our faculty. Second is it's in a vitally important new area of emerging science. Nanotechnologies and microtechnologies are ones which are, of course, on the covers of our news magazines, sometimes surrounded by great hype, but with an underlying core of enormous possible volatility and growth, estimated to be in about 10 to 15 years, something like a $1 trillion industry in the United States. The third is, as you know, this has an acute and keen congressional interest. So the possibility of federal funding to leverage that investment that you make is very high. The fourth is that it's arguable, and I believe it's true, that Oregon has a comparative advantage in this area because of the core faculty who have been involved long before the name nanoscience became associated with these ideas. The fifth is, of course, its enormous potential for spin-off enterprises that have the capacity to bring high wage and high family productivity jobs to us. And, of course, finally, and this is the outcome we hope for research generally, it has a high potential for human outcomes to better the lives of people and our fellow citizens. We have a 5-year plan for ONAMI. The slide before you is very general, but what we hope to do is bring in $60 to $80 million per year in federal and private research dollars and to raise $30 million in private construction costs. Totaled over the life of the 5-year period would be $200 million of new investment in Oregon. That would include the attraction of 50 world-class researchers, the spin-off of at least 15 companies and or new product lines of existing companies, to increase our licensing and patenting of intellectual property tenfold. And this, and I think it's important to note this, is that this is applicable across all industry sectors. I think it's highly misleading just to call this high technology as though that's a hermetically sealed a silo of particular endeavor. This touches forest products, it touches service and retail, it touches electronics, it touches biotechnology. So the enormous ranges of human endeavor from existing industries to new ones that could be established here is one of the payoffs that we expect to come. We've asked for, in light of this grand and achievable set of goals, a quite modest investment in this year's budget, $7 million of operating funds, because that's necessary to cover what federal grants and private industry don't. It's necessary for recruitment, It's necessary for the matching funds that federal grants invariably require in some respect. And it's necessary for funding of the intellectual property development, the invention disclosures, the patent applications, and the commercialization of our research. So again, it's a hugely leveraged investment and one that we believe has a high payoff. Let me now talk about three payoff areas that we've already seen in this short period of time between 2003, when you first made this investment upon our representations, and our present day. The miniature tactical energy systems. It's received $2.5 million from Congress this year to leverage state funds, and we're seeking $5 million more just this year. That helps us to develop tactical miniaturized energy systems that have a great deal to do at the present moment with our armed services, compact power supplies, portable fuel cells, other things that allow electronic and solar and other forms of energy to be stored and used more efficiently. The participants in this venture are committed to developing commercial opportunities of this particular technology from military uses into a wide range of civilian uses as rapidly as possible. Safer nanomaterials and nanomanufacturing. $2 million from Congress this last year to leverage state funds. We're seeking $5 million more in this category this year. This simultaneously meets the military's needs for high-performance materials while helping human health and minimizing environmental concerns. Nanometrology and nanoelectronics. We've received a $1.5 million grant to use algae to make nanoelectronics. And we're seeking a $5 million earmark from Congress this year.
President, may I stop you just for a moment?
Yes, you may. Thank you.
I'd like to ask members if you would be willing, please, to stay for an additional 5 minutes so that we can allow the President to get through his presentation. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I've had the foot on the vocal accelerator quite a bit. If you want me to slow down, I can also do that.
Just want to give you adequate time.
Thank
please
you,
continue.
Chair Gordy. We deeply appreciate the courtesy. And I think you can sense the excitement we feel about these emerging fields because they deal with a whole set of new materials, a whole set of collaborations that have had tangible and immediate impacts in terms of federal funding. President Bernstein and I will be going next week in separate trips back to Washington, D.C. to visit our congressional delegation to cement these relationships that we hope will result directly in the appropriations that I've identified for you in my testimony. So these are not gleams of the eye. These are realities of new infusions of research capital into the state of Oregon for the kinds of investments that are absolutely critical for our global future. I mentioned the nanoelectronics. These, of course, are the new developments that are required to measure what it is we're doing in nanotechnology because, of course, with this new technology, you cannot, with the naked eye, even see what it is that you're doing and manipulating. And therefore, the very industry of developing instrumentation is itself a new path-breaking frontier. Three examples of high-impact ideas for those who have experienced diabetes in their families, either with themselves or their loved ones. The exciting development of a Portland company called Home Dialysis Plus, which is using an Oregon State University-developed technology for portable kidney dialysis. It will probably very soon result in wearable dialysis devices that can process and filter at a speed not known now even by larger machines, which I think you can understand means that no longer will the daily three times a week trips to the hospital be necessary if, in fact, people can have these wearable devices done right here in Oregon, not someplace else, not some distant company. Transparent electronics. Researchers at Oregon State University and Hewlett-Packard are developing transparent transistors and other types of devices that could actually lead to foldable computers and foldable computer screens, which has enormous transportation weight and other advantages, as well as fantastic new industry spin-offs. And finally, new nanomaterials done at my own university, the University of Oregon, with material science. People who are actually constructing materials from the atoms and the molecule up rather than carving them down out of stone or wood. A whole new way of thinking about how it is that we construct things. I mentioned to you briefly Oregon's economy and the investments that have been made through ETIC. We've asked for a $21.7 million ETIC investment. This has, as you know, I hope you would guess, a huge leverage opportunity. These are concrete objectives, and we provide them to you now for our own accountability. We trust that through these we will double the number of engineering graduates, triple federal research dollars, and build on existing efforts at all seven OUS institutions, which are the recipients of ETIC funding. This builds a pipeline of knowledge that obviously isn't sufficient if it's just left in universities and colleges. And so for this purpose, we have key programs that actually reach into the high schools to encourage people to invest their own lives and careers in engineering and science and technology and mathematics much more robustly than has been the case in the past. Our results have been actually quite concrete, so this program, again, is not a gleam in the eye. Since the 1999 year, so the fifth year of our operation, we've seen in Oregon a 41% increase in engineering and science graduates from our institutions. We've seen a 39% increase in that five-year period in federal research dollars. We've attracted $93.6 million in private support. We've upgraded student laboratories and internship programs. We've grown our K-12 and community college partnerships and outreach programs. A few examples of these: we've expanded the computer science programs at Eastern, at Southern, and at Western, and at the University of Oregon. Portland State University has established a portable integrated circuitry design and test laboratory, and the Oregon Renewable Energy Center at OIT has been created in Klamath Falls. We have many more examples of these that time does not permit me, Madam Chair, to share with the committee, but I do hope that you will inquire into them, because these are tangible results of investment made only 5 years ago, and that should provide some evidence of the reality of the hopes that we have for engineering, science, technology for the future in the next 5 years based upon the investments we ask you to make. These are high-wage investments. They are not minimum wage jobs. The average wage of a science and technology job in Oregon last year was more than double the average wage in the state. That is to say, it was at about $68,000. That's the kind of job we need to create, and the more widely distributed in Oregon they are through these kinds of initiatives, the better off all Oregonians are. These jobs also are predicted, I think, as you know, to grow at faster rates than jobs are in other sectors of the economy. I mentioned that 50% of the American gross domestic product growth since World War II was because of research and development investments. These are targeted investments. They're actually quite modest in terms of what might be done, but they're a central core part of the higher education budget and other budgets that will reach you. And we ask for your favorable consideration of them, and deeply thank you for the time that you've spent, the extra time, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Thank you
very much, President Frondmeier, President Bernstein.
Questions?
Senator Walker.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. It'll be quick because I'm going to ask you to respond at a later date. President Frondmeier, you went in detail about the research in our universities, and it is all well and good. I don't know if you had an opportunity to see the Oregonian article, Washington Offers a Study in Higher Ed Success, on Sunday, February 13th. And they talked about how the University of Washington has outpaced us tremendously in funding and research. One of the areas that they talk about in the article that is a problem with, we have three research universities in the state, OHSU, Corvallis, the Beavers, and us in Eugene. And they state in here, OHSU has limited connections to the state's major research universities, Oregon State and Corvallis and U of O and Eugene. That separation makes it harder for OHSU to engage in research involving multiple disciplines. UW researchers repeatedly said their capacity to cross academic boundaries gives them an edge in winning grants. So I'd like you, if you can, to review that article and review the way we have our research separated in the state and how we can better utilize those grants and those opportunities so that we can excel at what we're doing.
Thank you, Senator Walker. I think we actually have a comprehensive response and reflections on that article in the Oregonian, and would be pleased to present that. But may I give you just two responses very quickly? The first is a comment by the chair of the Oregon Cancer Center from OHSU in a personal conversation with me just this last Saturday at a scientific meeting. And he reported that he was coming down to the University of Oregon again to engage in very productive conversations with our molecular biology faculty, and that this is something that he does and his colleagues do regularly. So this kind of scholarly exchange is actually occurring now, and I think is frankly overlooked at least or minimized by that particular article, because it's a very robust exchange. And of course the development of the web and the internet and the increasingly rapid telecommunications may make the distance problems of the past much less of an obstacle in the future. The second, Senator Walker, and I think you and the committee members are aware of it, but it's worth repeating, the University of Oregon will be engaged in medical education in conjunction with Sacred Heart Hospital and Oregon Health and Sciences University. We hope by the fall of 2006, dealing in some respect with students in years 1, 3, and 4 of OHSU in an effort to double the doctor output in Oregon over the next 10 years, because Oregon is facing a doctor shortage in 10 years that will be worse than any in the rest of the nation, unless we increase the output of physicians. So I think that kind of ground-up collaboration, which I hope I illustrated with my colleagues in the Onami incident, which is you don't have to be under the same name. You have to have the impulse to collaborate and the entrepreneurial urge to see opportunities and to seize them and to work together. And I think we've seen that on a landscape in Oregon higher education that has never been as rich as it is now.
Thank you, President Frohnmayer. I appreciate that response, because Oregonians, when they read newspapers, are left with sometimes impressions that are inaccurate. So it's our job to correct those.
We will close with a comment from Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is a great program. I think we're looking for solutions here. I think this committee is pretty much aware of the fact that we need more money in the system. So how are we going to get it? This is a long-term thing. We need to make that investment. You're providing this information. I appreciate that. Very well done. I also want to lobby you at this particular time also to say there are 12 states in the United States right now in this very difficult economic times that have a surplus. 8 of those are west of the Mississippi. They fulfill a specific niche. Hawaii has a tourist niche. Nevada has a gambling niche. The other 6 states basically use natural resources, with Alaska being the most significant. They do not have an income tax or a sales tax. They pay their citizens a dividend. They use their oil. I've been working with Dean Hal Sawasher at Oregon State University, considering what is Oregon good at. And he's, you know, forestry is one of those. He tells me there's 1 billion board feet of lumber that we should be harvesting in the state in a sustainable, economic friendly way, consistent with what the governor said in the state address. And so my plea is to you is that as leaders in a particular area, your underlying self-interest is to get more interest or more money into the system. And I think this committee up here is basically at that point too. So we need to do the technology thing. We need to do the natural resource. And to me, I see there's a great marriage of some potential here that we can actually move the state forward. Because if we don't do that, we're just going to become a mediocre state and just kind of bumble along. So that's just a comment. If you want to respond to it, that's good. But information for you folks more than anything else.
Thank you.
There will be other opportunities for you to respond. Senator Nelson continues to put forth a challenge, which is a challenge to all of us, all of Oregon. I want to thank the presidents again for their participation this afternoon and members for staying overtime. At this point, we close the public hearing on Senate Bill 5513. Have a great day.
Thank you.